So tonight, in these weeks leading up towards our celebration of Buddha's enlightenment, which is like the high holy days of Zen, you know, coming up in December, the Rohatsu celebration. Leading up to that, I thought we would take up, have a series of talks and take up one of the Buddha's teachings called the Seven Factors of Awakening, or the Seven Factors of Enlightenment. Buddha identified seven sort of aspects of mind or factors of mind that he said were particularly important to cultivate and recognize and uncover, if you will, to support awakening. And a really important subtext of all of these kinds of teachings, which we have to really kind of remind ourselves of again and again, is that the mind matters. And not just the contents, you know, or the story, or the topic of the thinking, but the full dimensions of the mind. The way the mind flows, the ways the sort of currents of the mind get caught on things, get constricted in various ways, and then can open up again, and be sort of unlimbered and freed again. The mind matters in that it helps for us to have a better understanding of our relationship to the different aspects of mind, our relationship to our thinking and our emotions, our relationship to perception. It all matters. It's all somewhat habitual, though. And so these practices and teachings are to remind us in a way that the mind matters, and that it can be practiced with and investigated in various ways, that we maybe have more of an opportunity in life to recognize the patterning and the function of mind and practice with that in a way that is conducive to awakening. And it's interesting because we know full well that the body has to be cared for, that what we eat matters, that getting enough exercise matters, that getting enough sleep matters. We don't always take the most skillful action that we could with the body, right? We miss a day or a month of exercise. We stay up too late and so on. But we're not surprised when we're tired the next day, right? We know that that's how it goes. We know that we have some obligation to care for the body if we want to be happy and healthy. But somehow we have the idea that the mind should just take care of itself. And that if the external circumstances are right, the mind will just be fine. And whatever we think the external circumstances are, maybe having the right job, or having good friends who treat us in the way that they're supposed to, according to us. Or maybe we think the right spiritual practice will give us the right sort of external circumstances, and the mind will just be fine. Happy, settled, relaxed mind. And it's not that we totally ignore the mind, we really value learning, right? We really value learning in our culture and education. But in that education, we privilege content. We value people who become experts in the content areas of knowledge. And we do experience learning, I think, as satisfying in itself. And we expect the learning of stuff to lead to some happiness and some contentment, either directly, or maybe learning the right stuff will lead to better external circumstances, which will then make us happy, right? Like a good career or something like this. And so these teachings of Buddha that I want to bring up, these seven factors, are more about the process of mind and less about the content of mind, more about how the mind works. What are the aspects and qualities of mind? What the Buddha called factors. Now, I forgot to look up what word is being translated as factors, but I think it's a fairly literal translation. And I don't know if it was the Buddha or a little bit later, the great sort of meditative scientists who created the Abhidharma, this system of Buddhist psychology. I think that's mostly after the Buddha's life. But they decided that there are exactly 52 mental factors. 52 aspects of mind, so we can think of it as a deck, like a deck of cards. We all hopefully start with a full deck. If we don't, none of us have a full deck, right? So that's a problem. Then you have psychology and so on. You need to add some cards in there. Or maybe we have like a few jokers where we should have had a, you know, should have a seven of clubs. We have a joker standing in, and then it turns into something else. And what's interesting too about this is just the tremendous access that we now have to this, the amount of scholarship that's happened in English and how accessible things are on the internet. So I'm not going to go into it, but I had heard of these, you know, different factors, different dharmas of mind. And I'd always wondered, like, well, you know, they always highlight a few, you know, but what's the whole list? You know, I can never find out the whole list. Like, you have to, like, be a major Abhidharma scholar and go to, like, some dusty book in a deep university library to find this out. At least that used to be true. Now, Google. 52 mental factors. And I got a very nicely organized PDF. Very clear. Nice diagrams. So I won't tell you what they all are, but, you know, some are positive things, some are not so positive, some are things that are sort of always present, they're organized in different groups, some are things that are always pleasant or very common, like perception is a mental factor, and other ones are things that come and go, you know, some things are associated with greed and hatred, some things are associated with kindness and generosity and so on. So they've got this way of organizing the mental factors. There's one list called the 25 beautiful mental factors. These are positive things that we think of. Tranquility is one, for instance. And there are different sort of versions and permutations. So anyway, there's all these mental factors. The you know, our psychology is sort of a psychology from the outside looking in to a certain extent. Our sciences in general, sort of the outside looking in. And so Buddhist psychology was sort of an experiential psychology of experience from the inside out. So they carefully watched their thoughts, you know, and figured out they could organize them into 52 categories. And so the Buddha picked out seven of these that he felt were most important to this process of waking up. So what do we mean by waking up? It's an important question. So it might be waking up to a sort of flexible, interpenetrated, open-hearted life. Where we don't cling on to our problems as problems in the same way that we might do before these factors are fully enlivened. Where there's just the joy of being in experience, you know, including everything, including tears and troubles, triumphs and joys, things arising, things passing away. So the Buddha's awakening is a sort of being awake to or present to or free in the middle of everything that's coming and going. And it also implies a lack of quite a few unhealthy things that we do. And usually in traditional Buddhism, these things are described in the negative, so we have to sort of like make it up in English in the postmodern era if we want to say it in a positive way. But in traditional Buddhism, it's always described in the negative. Like, awakening is characterized by a lack of greed, a lack of hatred, you know, a lack of confusion and delusion, by having experiences that we don't add suffering to, that we don't add confusion too. And so in the positive, maybe it's something like just showing up, really showing up for the full show of our life, which is my definition of, I wrote on here my definition of the moment, but I wrote this a few hours ago, so it's already changed, you know. But showing up, really showing up for our life and not being hindered by our life. And so there's some natural joy there when suffering is gone. And I think we think about things in terms of states. We would like to have a happier state. And so it's possible to think of awakening as a state, a sort of state where you're really just right there. Or maybe it's more helpful to think of this as a process. Showing up more fully, more often, more of the time, less often being caught in confusion, delusion, anger, wishing things were other than the way they are. So I remember we used to always pass around Joko Beck and read. Remember those days? We used to pass around Joko Beck and she talks about it in terms of percentages in there, actually. She's like, you know, it would be really nice if you could be like 13% of the time not reacting instead of like, you know, whichever way she said it, you know. She was pretty modest in her percentages. I forget what she said exactly, but, you know, just a few percentage more, you make the happier choice. That would be great. So here are the seven mental factors that lead to awakening, says the Buddha. I'll read them to you and we'll talk about them a little bit in aggregate, and I have a handout for you too for later. So they are mindfulness, discernment, diligence, joy, lightness and ease, that's one, samadhi or concentration, and wisdom. So mindfulness, discernment or inquiry, diligence, joy, lightness and ease can also be tranquility or calm, concentrated awareness, and wisdom. And what's interesting is there's two primary ways that this list is looked at in the commentaries on it. One is as a stepwise list, which is probably what the first thing we think of. That first you practice mindfulness, become a little more aware of what's actually happening, as opposed to what you think might be happening. And that mindfulness allows you to more accurately discern what's happening, and so then discernment can be there. You can inquire more accurately, and you can be more interested too, actually, in the actual moments of unfolding experience at a very baseline experiential level. So mindfulness leads to discernment. And then once you're starting to be more mindful of what's happening and discerning more accurately what's happening, diligence arises naturally, like, wow, this is really helping me. You know, I feel grounded, I feel aware, this feels like less of my crazy story, so you really get motivated, you know, just like, yes, this is great. And then once you're motivated and discerning and mindful, there, then actually joy arises, and you've probably all experienced this at different times. Like, you suddenly feel like, wow, you know, I actually feel like really happy, you know, and it's not because of, you know, I got some benny from somebody, it's just like the happiness of being alive arises. And the joy, piti, I think is the word in Pali, is a kind of exuberant, kind of effervescent joy. And then once that's arising, then the next one is more of a calm, sort of tranquility type of joy that's translated, my current favorite being lightness and ease, so sort of easefulness. So see, there's a progression here. And then once there's a lightfulness and an ease and a joy, then naturally we're pretty concentrated, right? We're just right here, you know? We don't need to be distracting ourselves, you know, anymore. And we're less distracted by the things that are running around us. And all that leads to wisdom. And wisdom here means discernment into what is going to keep this whole thing running in a positive way. You know, what's skillful here? What's unskillful? What's going to lead to more joy and less suffering in myself and others? So that's how we would naturally think of it. Like, I do this, then I get this, then I get this, this. But another way to look at it is that we actually already have all these things. All these qualities are qualities of mind that are always present, but we don't always notice them. They're somehow occluded or covered up or, you know, sort of jumbled. And another way to look at this list of seven is that it's a balancing. If one thing is kind of too big, then we kind of let that calm down and we see if we can discern and notice and sort of cultivate the things that we're not noticing in this list of seven. And when you think of it as, and that's maybe helpful to us too, because when you think of it as a progression, you're like, I got a program here, you know, time to get busy and time to fail, right? And time to fail. The minute we have a program and we're trying to get busy and accomplish something, we're set up for failure. So this balance idea can help us. So there's sort of a balance between approaches, and one of the approaches is balance. And in the balance idea, mindfulness is like the fulcrum in the middle. And on one side are the first three, which are sort of active. The next three, I mean, discernment, diligence, and joy are on one side of the balance scale. You're discerning, you're diligent, you're like exuberant, you're excited, this is working. It's sort of like uplifted on one side. And the other side is more sort of cooling out on the other side of the balance scale. Calming down, being concentrated, accessing wisdom, and so. But mindfulness is right on the center, so I just want to talk a little bit about mindfulness tonight, and we'll talk a little bit about mindfulness next week too, because mindfulness is just so key. And, you know, no wonder that mindfulness kind of hopped, you know, the religion wall out into the secular society, and you know, and I've been enjoying getting to participate that in that myself. This morning actually had a class with 15 people in this room, most of whom have very little interest in Buddhism, but are interested in mindfulness and are interested in happiness, right? So mindfulness, in the main sutra that we have about mindfulness, which is it's called the Satipatthana Sutta in the old teachings of Buddha, just means the sutra on mindfulness, you know. In that, the Buddha is really enthusiastic about mindfulness, and he uses a fairly unusual adjective. I forget what the adjective was in Pali right now, but it's been difficult to translate, apparently. Like, originally it was translated as, like, wonderful, or the best of all, or just, you know, superior. He says mindfulness is the superior, best of all thing. But then the other day I was reading Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's one of these amazing sort of educated Westerners who ordained in Sri Lanka and just devoted his life to studying this early Buddhist material and translating it. He was a New York lawyer originally, I think, Bhikkhu Bodhi, yeah. He was a New York lawyer, Bhikkhu Bodhi, yeah, so he's a very reliable translator. So I was reading some commentary by him on this word, which I'll bring you the word next week, and he said, well, actually, it doesn't really exactly mean the best or superior. It means that which only leads forward, without regression, without turning back. So that's what Bhikkhu Bodhi thinks this word is that the Buddha uses in the sutra to describe the process and the value of mindfulness, that if you practice mindfulness, there's no going back. It just leads forward to more awareness, more awakening, you know, all these desirable qualities. So that's nice, you know. You're not going to regress, you know. There's no regression. You may regress from where you think you are, but that's a different problem. You know? That's what you think. And so in that sutra, he talks about sort of four frames or four areas for practicing mindfulness. And I know we've talked about this many times, but it's worth bringing it back to mind and really trying to memorize this and remember it. So sometimes these four areas are called like foundations, like places you could really build something strong. And just recently we were saying the other day that I've seen it retranslated as frames of reference. Four frames of reference for practice. And the frames of reference is nice because we always have a frame of reference, right? We always have some view or some idea of who we are and what's happening. And we know that our frame of reference is somewhat limited, right? And so the Buddha is saying, like, well, take up a whole different frame of reference for a time in your practice. And be mindful, meaning return to, be aware of, in a very moment-by-moment way, what's occurring within that frame, and let the other things be secondary. And of course, our main frame of reference is me, right? Me, 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 me. So this is trying to bring up an alternative, which is pretty skillful, I think. We can't sort of repress the me, me, me thing, right? That doesn't work. Sometimes you see people, you know, trying to strangle their me-ness, you know, but it doesn't work. But you can bring forward an alternative and let the me, me, me be a little quieter. So the four frames of reference, the first one is the body, actually. First one is the body. So we practice actually feeling the sensations in the body. You know, we can move the body and take care of the body in different ways. You know, yoga and exercise are part of this. But with an important sort of qualifier, to do yoga, to do exercise, not as a way to like fix the body or make the body stronger or sort of solve some sort of problem of having a body, but to cultivate awareness of the body and the feeling of the body, to really be inside the body. In the sutra, the Buddha always uses a phrase, something like mindful of the body in the body, or the body as the body. So watching out for our tendency to sort of objectify everything, like make the body some object down there that the little mind control center is trying to sort of take care of, you know. Beep, beep, body down there, you know. No, to body from the inside out. And in the foundation of mindfulness, that's the body, he includes the breath. So that's where breath awareness is. That's part of why breath awareness is so central. It's like the first part of what he says is this one-way path, you know, this incredibly helpful way of practicing. And so you feel the breathing body, right? So again, there we can also turn the breath into a mental object or an idea. So to be sure when we're practicing that we're engaging the experience of breathing in the body. So that's the most important one, and then the next three are all sort of different aspects of what we think of as mind. The first one is the sort of low, the second foundation, the first of those next three, is what's usually translated as feelings, which I find very problematic. Sometimes they translate it as feeling tone, but it really kind of means at a low level, what do we sense and how do we react to what we sense really quickly, like even before we think about it, just that kind of gut level, like I like this, I don't like this. So lately I'm calling it sensations and reactions, kind of before thinking is the second one. So to be sensitive to how we kind of lean in and out of experience all day, like, oh, like that, oh, don't like that, or neutral, which we usually don't notice. So then the third one is the thinking itself, the way we use the mind to form things, to create things. Sometimes they say mental formations, but you know, from our frame, it's thinking and emotion. But to be able to practice seeing, thinking, and emotion, not, again, as the me, getting what it wants or not getting what it wants, and very frustrated, right? But to see thoughts and emotions as events arising in the mind. Oh, look, there's a thought, you know? And there it goes again. And hooked up to these thoughts, right? And of course, noticing some of them are quite a bit more charged than others, right? But just kind of starting to practice with and actually feel the huge difference between something like, God, I hate it when she does that, and, oh, judgment's arising. You know? I mean, it's the same mental experience, but described in a different way. One very tight and clingy, you know, and one liberating and fluid and allowing the judgment to come and to go. And then what's interesting about the fourth of these four foundations of mindfulness that are implied by this first of the seven factors is this gets confusing, so listen to this carefully. So we have the seven factors. The first one is mindfulness. When mindfulness is described, it's in these four categories, these four foundations. The fourth one is basically a bunch of Buddhist lists that describe the sort of patterning of reality. And among the lists that are described is the seven factors of enlightenment. So it sort of all folds back in on itself in different ways that are a little frustrating to our Western mind, where we want like a tree diagram and what's the first thing, what's the last thing. And you know, one thing refers to another thing and the other thing refers right back to the first thing. So it's sort of circular, but it's how the mind really works, it seems like. So one of the lists in this fourth foundation is right back to the seven. But another one that's really important is the five hindrances. So the five hindrances are included in this final area of being mindful. And the way I've kind of come to translate this final area, in the traditional, the translation is it's mindfulness of dharmas, of experience, but then he doesn't really talk about an experience in a way that makes sense to us. He just brings up these lists. But I realize it's actually kind of a list of habits and patterns from a certain sort of frame. And so the five hindrances are also worth studying, and so I'll give you a little handout here when we get to the lobby with the five hindrances and these seven factors of enlightenment. Because they're seen as sort of working together in a certain way. That the seven factors are an antidote to the five hindrances. And that when the hindrances arrive, they're sort of like signals. You know, they're sort of like somebody waving a flag, you know. Time to study the seven factors because the hindrance is arriving. And the five hindrances, I always had trouble remembering what they were, but then I realized it's actually pretty easy to remember. So there are two pairs of related qualities, the first four, and then the fifth one is doubt. Doubt, right? Doubting that any of this could ever work, doubting that we're ever going to change, doubting that the world, you know, doubt, you know, big doubt. And so the two pairs are desire and aversion are the first pair. We want stuff, we don't want stuff. Desire and aversion are the first pair, which shows up all through Buddhism, right? The second pair are dullness and restlessness. So being a little too dull or too sleepy on the one hand, or a little too, you know, amped up or jaggy on the other hand. So dullness and restlessness. These are not the usual English translations, but I'm on a re-translation kick, so I think these are better. Dullness is usually translated as sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor, which is so cute, but you know, it's like it's so sort of dorky that you just kind of chuckle and then you forget it. But dullness, I think we can relate to. Like, you know, we often feel kind of dull, right? Kind of low energy, kind of down, not quite engaging with the world. And sometimes we just sort of, you know, sink into that dullness like a, you know, oozy, you know, goop. And so when these things arise, they're kind of a way of encouraging us, which is interesting. The way they look at it in Buddhism, we look at these as just purely like problems. Don't want that. Hindrance is bad, 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 bad. But the way it's looked at in the system is like, well, actually, when the hindrance arises, it's an encouragement to practice. You're like, oh, wow, I feel dull. How do I work with that, you know? How do I bring forward the positive factors of awakening to work with that? And so I thought our task for this next week, if you want to, is to get a little familiar with these two lists. You know, take the handout with you and, you know, kind of read them and put them on the fridge or whatever. But then especially see if you can notice, what are the hindrances that are most present for me? And what are the hindrances that are arising most? And can I practice mindfulness in that moment, you know? Can I feel the body when dullness arises, or whatever it is for you? Which of those hindrances, you know, when, you know, agitation arises, can I be mindful of the body? Can I be mindful of the way I'm kind of reacting to experience? Can I be mindful of the thinking? And then over the next however many weeks, we'll just take each factor and maybe each hindrance. We'll see how long we want to spend on this and kind of come up with other ways to look at it and practice with it. So that's kind of my plan, and I didn't really leave time for discussion tonight because I kind of wanted to lay out a framework. So that's that. A lot of words. Let's just, before we ring out, let's just sit for a moment. And just breathe into the feeling in the body. Because as we become more sensitive to feelings in the body, you know, we can feel everything we do has a sort of imprint in the body, has an effect. So just sitting here listening to my talk and whatever happened today, you know, the body is sort of tuned into that. And to see if we can stop from time to time and feel the body. Feel the sensations. And let whatever it is just settle a little bit.